everybody. Welcome back. We're just getting settled here with Tom Engelhardt, who for 35 years drew editorial cartoons for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, some 8,000 of them. He did so through some of our country's and community's most difficult times. A lot of history is chronicled in his cartoons and in his book, Four Turbulent Decades, A Cartoon History of America from 1962 to 2001. And Tom joins me in studio to talk about his career. Nice to see you again, sir. How are you?
You too, Don. Thanks. Doing fine. And you also, I hope.
Well, I think so, so far. You know, I was thinking when getting ready for you to be here today that maybe you would like to be drawing cartoons today. And today's world, I mean, it's just full of things to capture the imagination of someone like yourself.
It is. It is. And, you know, you really have mixed feelings. It's so sad. I've been aware of wars ever since I was a little kid. And, you know, things were going on between China and Japan and then Hitler invading Eastern Europe and things like that, or Western, too. So it just seems to be never ending.
You know, another thing that occurs to me, and we have to talk about this for a moment, is that political cartoonists, editorial cartoonists today seem to have a bullseye on their back. There are a lot of people out there who are watching very closely, particularly if they do anything with regard to Islam.
Well, that's always been part of the game anyway. You're always going to get people who disagree with you. Of course, that's how politics and democracy and everything work. So it's not unusual. I kind of liked it when I got those nasty letters or phone calls. And one time when one of our daughters was about 13, she said, "Oh, Dad, I really hate it when they print those letters about your cartoons in the paper." And I said, "Oh, Carol, don't worry about it. I love to get people stirred up."
That's the whole point of what you're supposed to be doing, isn't it?
It is, yeah. You're kind of saying, hey, people, they can't do this to us.
Sure.
You've got to wake up and vote or do something.
That really is your job, isn't it, to really prod people into thinking and maybe thinking intelligently about some of the things facing us today.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But what I was getting at was, you know, the Charlie Hebdo incident in France and the Danish cartoonists, you know, who've had so much difficulty, the recent situation down in Texas where they had a cartoon festival of some sort and a person was killed down there. It's one thing to get mail where people disagree with you. It's another thing to have people shooting at you.
Yeah, but see, I draw a line there, Don. I don't go after anybody's religion or religious beliefs or whatever. I think those are sacred to each person. I would never touch those subjects, and I think those cartoons myself I thought were pretty darn bad.
Well, let's hope that we've seen the last of them and that more cartoonists take your attitude. I think that's going to have to happen.
Yeah.
Tom, what kind of pressure is on the cartoonist today and throughout your entire career? I mean, every day, six days a week anyway, you've got to come up with something, and it's got to be pretty darn good. How do you do that day after day?
You hope it's good.
Well, most of the time, with you, it was.
There's some kind of little engine you have inside your body that, you know, just makes you mad about political situations or what is going on as far as innocent people, civilians and people like that being brutalized and murdered in wars and, you know, by bandits or whatever it might be. So it gets you pretty well stirred up. You don't have to stop and think, oh, what should I do today, unfortunately.
What about your own personal position on issues? I mean, you've got to put that aside, I suppose, from time to time. Or do you have free range to draw whatever you want?
Well, I'll tell you, Don, the Post-Dispatch was really a great place to work. They had an unwritten gentleman's agreement that said, you will never be forced to draw or write anything against your own beliefs, and conversely, we won't print anything that goes against our principles. So within that framework, there is lots of leeway to play around with it. But you have to start out looking for a job with an outfit that you think you could live with and be happy with. I called it going into a professional marriage, so that if you met some person of the opposite sex you wanted to marry, you wouldn't marry them if they had different kinds of morals or outlooks on financial affairs or how to raise kids. It's the same way with getting a job like this. You find a place that you think you can live with.
I enjoyed the portion of your book in which you and Jules Feiffer had a conversation. Of course, he's among the most famous of the cartoonists in the country. And the way you went back and forth, it's kind of a closed community in the sense that everybody seems to know everybody else in this business.
Well, there are very few of us.
Yeah.
Not a whole lot. I hate to guess how many, maybe several hundred. In the whole country.
It's a small group.
It is. It is. And I found out when I was looking for a job, when I was in New York City years ago, I could write any cartoonist, you know, professional who was already working and ask if I could come talk to them and maybe get some advice. They are always very welcoming people. They're really nice to me.
You tell an interesting story in the book about how you came to the Post-Dispatch. Why don't you tell us how that all worked out?
How much time do you have? Well, I had sent out lots of brochures and mailing pieces on myself trying to get a job. And I could do that because when I was in New York, I was freelancing as an advertising artist, so I knew how to do that stuff. And well, when we were, my wife and I were in Cleveland and we had one baby and another one on the way, when I got fired from the syndicate there after only 1 year. But it didn't make me unhappy at all because I wasn't happy working at that place. So finally, after I'd been out of work about 6 or 7 months, I heard there is going to be an ASNE, American Society of Newspaper Editors convention, on in New Orleans. And I said to my wife, I'm going to go to New Orleans and see if I can buttonhole some editors down there. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have much money. I took a bus down. Hugh Haney, the cartoonist of the Louisville Courier-Journal, was very kind and helpful. He introduced me to Barry Bingham and Norman Isaacs, a former St. Louisan, who were working at the Courier-Journal. And they say, well, when you get to New Orleans, if there's anybody you want to meet, just let us know and we'll fix you up. So those were really kind of morale boosters. But when I got there, one thing, I was drawing unemployment pay from Ohio. And you had to show that you applied to 3 different places for a job in a week.
That you were actively looking for work.
Yes, in order to get a paycheck. Well, I ran out of papers that I thought I could live with, and I started writing other cartoonists. And, of course, they didn't know anybody who would have an opening. But I had written Bill Malden, who was then at the Post-Dispatch. And I was walking through the hotel in New Orleans where the conference was being held, and I saw Bill Malden at the phone booth there. And I went up and introduced myself, and, Tom, I'm sorry I haven't answered your letter yet, and all that sort of thing. But let's have a drink after 5 o'clock or whatever. So I met him back there at 5 o'clock, and as we're heading into the bar, here was this distinguished-looking, white-haired gentleman leaning up against the doorpost, and he and Bill exchanged greetings. And this gentleman said, do you mind if I join you? And Bill said, no, come ahead. So we're sitting at the table having our drinks, and I said jokingly to Malden, Bill, why don't you ask your boss sometime if there would be an opening for a second cartoonist when you go on vacation or maybe get sick or whatever? And he waves to this man and says, well, ask him. It was his boss, Bob Lash. So, you know, we just laughed it off and didn't go any further there. But then I asked Bill if I could. I was coming back through St. Louis to visit my folks because I grew up here. And I said, Bill, while I'm in St. Louis, could I come down to the Post and visit with you? And he said, oh, sure. So I did that, and we were heading out to lunch. And, oh, boy, Bob Lash came, and also the assistant editor of the editorial page, George Hall. So Bob and I were walking across 12th Street. Well, it was called 12th then, Tucker now, to the restaurant, and he said, you know, I was thinking what you said about having a second cartoonist, and I checked with the art department, but they don't have any openings right now. But if you send me some of your samples, I'll be sure to keep them on file in case an opening comes up. Oh, boy, that's great. And one of the things Bill Malden asked me was, well, did you get any nibbles when you were in New Orleans? And I said, well, the man at the Dayton Daily News was interested, but he said they couldn't afford a cartoonist now. And the man at the Chicago Sun-Times was really pretty interested. He asked me to send samples to him. So as soon as I got back to Cleveland, I got a subscription to the Chicago Sun-Times so I could see what it was like, and I sent samples off. And after 4 or 5 days, I said to my wife, I could never work for this paper. It wouldn't work. They're too conservative for me and that sort of thing. But in the meantime, I was checking with the lady in this man's office. And she said, no, he's in Alaska. He won't be back for a while. But I'll have him call you. Well, I never got a call. And this all was happening in late April and early May. And in early June, my sister called from St. Louis and said, Tom, guess what? I said, what? Bill Malden quit the Post-Dispatch. And I said, and she said, well, guess where he's going? And I said, where? And she said, the Chicago Sun-Times. So I thought that was great that
there's an opening.
He took off, yeah. And so I contacted Bob Lash, and he said, well, we're going to interview 3 cartoonists, and why don't you send me samples of your work as if you're working every day now as a cartoonist? Mm-hmm. So I did that, and after a little while, he called and said, well, we're going to interview 3 cartoonists. You'll be one of them, and the other 2 are working at jobs already. Keep sending cartoons and stuff. So in early August, they decided to interview all 3 of us on successive Mondays and Tuesdays, and I was the first one they called down. And, oh, boy, that was some interview with Joe Pulitzer and Bob Lash and George Hall.
It went right to the top for that interview, that's for sure.
Being put through the ringer. But they're all very nice people. That was on Monday. And then on Tuesday, I had a talk with each individual editorial writer. Yeah. And that was nice, too. They're all good people.
And ultimately, as time begins to get away a little bit, Tom, ultimately, you got the job, obviously.
I did.
Well, you know, I wanted to get into that story because I wanted to pay particular attention to the first cartoon you did with the Post-Dispatch. It's also the first cartoon in your book, Addendum. Yeah. And the reason I wanted to bring that up is because it's absolutely relevant today. And what it is it's the Confederate flag with a skull.
Yeah.
And what was that story? What prompted that?
Well, that weekend, just before I was going to start work on Monday, October 1st, 62, I was thinking, oh, boy, I've got to have an idea. I can't walk in there and say, I don't have an idea yet. So there wasn't really much news cartoon-wise floating around at that time. But on that Sunday before the Monday I started, James Meredith was supposed to be allowed into the University of Mississippi Law School. And the white students down there rioted. Mm. 2 people were killed. Meredith luckily got out with his life, I guess. And so there's all this kind of turmoil. Well, you know, I said, this is what I got to do, because I've been interested in civil rights forever, it seems. So that's what I did.
Yeah. And it, as I say, it's very relevant today because the Confederate flag is undergoing so much scrutiny, and a number of public places are going to be removed, apparently, from the way it looks.
Well, you know, that's a funny thing, Don. I enlisted in the Air Force in 1951 when the Korean War was on. And there were 5 of us from Colorado. I was going to art school out there at the time. And we got 5 of us got shipped to Texas for basic training. Most of the guys in our little squadron were from Georgia, Florida, Mississippi, Alabama. they were still fighting the Civil War.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. So I hadn't thought about the Civil War since second year of high school.
a lot of people are still fighting it, apparently.
They are.
And another of the cartoons that I remember very, very distinctly, the day that it came out, is probably my favorite, is the Weeping Eagle, the Challenger, Challenger disaster.
Yeah.
That was just so poignant, so touching. Is that one of your favorites as well?
I guess so. Those are hard cartoons to draw. In this case, of course, it was a humongous disaster. But any time some well-known, outstanding person dies, like Winston Churchill or Adlai Stevenson or whomever, it's very hard to do that. And you're not trying to say, oh, this is really bad. You don't want to mess with it. You want to hold somebody up in that case.
Yeah.
But I just, played around with it for a while and settled on that. The only trouble was I wish I had put something in there that said it referred to the Challenger. St. Louis people would know that because the headlines on the Post-Dispatch and everything were about that. But my cartoons were reprinted in some places. And I think it was in Louisville where a man called me and he said, well, does that refer to the Challenger or the new tax increase that Congress just voted?
You could have said both, right?
Yeah.
and it worked. Do you have a favorite, one that stands out? I mean, you did almost 8,000 of them with the Post-Dispatch. I mean, it's hard to sift through that, I'm sure, but there may be one that stands out in your mind.
I don't know. Maybe some of those on Nixon.
You had a field day with Nixon.
Yeah, that was a real battle. Actually, I would rather have had the politics work better for our country than when he was president. But I don't know. I just can't think of one offhand.
Nixon, pretty easy to draw. Nixon and also LBJ, Lyndon Johnson.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about today's crop? I mean, I would have to think, as we started this interview, that Donald Trump might be somebody you want to have some fun with if you were drawing
yeah.
today with the hair. Is that the case? Do you sometimes long for the opportunity to do that?
No. Believe it or not, I would like the politics of our country to work well and be fair to everybody. I don't know. That's our job, is to point out the bad guys, of course. So I'd much rather have the country work well. But we're always confronted.
And always have been. I mean, the political cartooning is not something new. I mean, it goes back to the earliest days of our country's history and beyond that, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I've got a PowerPoint talk I give, Don. Oh, I can put in a little plug for the talk at the county library.
I've got it right here.
Oh, okay.
7 o'clock at the library headquarters on Lindbergh to discuss the book, and that's going to be on this Wednesday night.
Yeah, the books will be there for sale, but I'm really going to talk about the history of editorial cartooning. Mm-hmm. And I found cartoons back to the 15th century when cartoonists were going after, the murders and rapists and crooked politicians and money in politics.
In other words, things haven't changed much in the last 500, 600 years, huh?
No, they haven't. Okay.
I wanted to ask you about the future of political cartooning. We all know and lament what's happening in the newspapers all over the country.
Yes.
What sort of a future do political cartoonists and editorial cartoonists have, do you think?
I hate to say I'm awfully pessimistic, Don. First of all, just because of the situation with newspapers in general. But the cartoonists today don't seem to put any passion into their thoughts or ideas or what they're trying to preach. They strike me as very lame. I don't think the drawings are good. I love to draw. You know, I'd be working on my drawing board at the Post and thinking, I can't believe they're paying me to have all this fun.
Yeah.
But I think you got to have good drawings to get your point across. They just don't seem to show that.
Who's the best out there right now, would you say?
Danziger, I like. I haven't seen him in a long time. He was with the Christian Science Monitor. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he's still there. Boy, I don't know. I just haven't seen any that I really like so much as I did the ones 30 years ago.
It would seem that the trend today, and it's a powerful one, is that everything is moving online.
Yes.
Is there a place online for political cartoonists and cartooning?
I don't know. I have no idea, Don. I think that because of the very nature of the medium, you can't get any kind of warmth or depth into the drawing on a computer screen that you can on a piece of paper and reproduce it in another paper.
And when you were drawing for the Post, what materials did you use? In your interview with Pfeiffer, you talked about grease pencils and crayons, yes, and that sort of thing. Yeah. I didn't realize that. I always thought it was a pen and ink.
No. Pen and ink, of course, is always very sharp and black and white. But if you want to get grays and have some subtle shading or something, there's nothing like a grease crayon or graphite crayon. Not graphite, but the grease type. And when Fitzpatrick was at the Post-Dispatch, he used a lumber crayon.
What is that?
Oh, if you work in a lumber yard, you have to mark the grades of the...
Kind of a flat. It's a flat lead, isn't it?
I don't think his was. And it wasn't lead or graphite. It's a greasy kind of thing. Not real greasy, but it leaves a mark on some place that might get wet or out in the weather and that sort of thing. So it holds up really well.
Well, he was there for forever, wasn't he?
45 years.
Yeah. Well, and how much of a mentor was he or was he to you?
Well, he was a good guy. He was very helpful. Another one of those people who was very kind with his help and everything. But at that time, I was living in New York, and he was in St. Louis. We corresponded for a while. And then when I came back here to start the job, every so often, Bob Lash would invite Fitz downtown to have lunch with us. And Fitz would give me his advice and stuff.
Only 30 seconds left. Do you miss it? Do you miss the daily grind?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I wish I had an outlet now, but I'm doing other kinds of artwork, so.
You're keeping busy.
Yes.
Well, that is great to hear. Tom Engelhart, great to see you again. Congratulations on the book. A reminder once again, you're going to be at the County Library headquarters on Lindbergh at 7 o'clock on Wednesday evening. You'll have a PowerPoint presentation, plenty of opportunity to see all those great cartoons. Thank you for being with us, Don.
You're welcome, Don.
Best
Thanks for
luck.
Having me.
Best of luck to you. That does it for us for today. But tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with Anna Croslin about her 37-year career working with refugees as head of the International Institute of St. Louis. She's also the winner of a recent White House award. We'll also take a look at the St. Louis Mosaic Project's efforts to make the region the fastest-growing metropolitan area for immigration by the year 2020. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.